Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week we'll discuss infrastructure investment with Congressman Peter Welch and workplace concerns at the Federal Aviation Administration with AFGE Local 2282 President Greg Brooks. We'll also address the importance of the Hispanic vote with Democratic National Committee Senior Advisor for Hispanic Affairs Juan Sepulveda. But first, we've been joined by new AFGE National Secretary Treasurer Eugene Hudson Jr. NST Hudson, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is your first interview with us here in your new role, AFGE's National Secretary Treasurer. What does it mean to you personally to have taken on this position?
It means that I have an opportunity to help the organization that I love to become more fruitful and visible, and hopefully to help increase the membership and to help mainly the workers that we represent. That's the main goal, is to help the workers that we represent in the federal sector.
You have a long tradition and history with the union, 30 years as an official in various different capacities, most recently as a national vice president for AFGE. How do you think some of those experiences and some of the things that you've gone through will serve you well in this new role as NST?
Well, since I come from California, Southern California in particular, there's a lot of diversity in Southern California. I've had to deal with people of all ethnicity. I believe that that experience will help me to deal with the diversity in the federal sector. For instance, I've dealt with Border Patrol agents, Social Security workers, VA workers, DOD workers, Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, Army, Homeland Security, Coast Guard, ICE, just to name a few agencies. I think my cross experience will benefit me in understanding their culture and which agencies they come from. And I think that being a national vice president has allowed for me to go have a spectrum of different issues I've had to deal with, for instance, trusteeships, where we had to remove people from office and actually take control of the union and do the representation and do the all the necessary compliance reports with the Internal Revenue Service, with the Department of Labor, and the internal reports with the National AFGE. I've also worked with the state Fed in California, State Federation of Labor, California Labor Federation, where we dealt with state issues and state assemblymen and state senators on various issues and other affiliates, Teamsters, teachers, the United Food and Commercial Workers Unions, so SEIU and many other unions that I've had to deal with in addressing issues concerning federal workers. During the TSA campaign, some of those same unions I just mentioned were very helpful in helping us to win that election. If they had not given us the help we need, we may not have prevailed in that election. It cost us a lot of money and a lot of time to prevail in the election for TSA workers. And hopefully now that we have a contract negotiated, it'll be ratified by the workers in the next 30 days or less.
When you look ahead to the next 3 years, what are your top three goals that you would like to accomplish as National Secretary Treasurer?
Well, there was a publication that came out recently attacking or ridiculing AFG about the number of officers within the organization that have been charged with theft of union funds. One of my goals is to clean that up. It's just a serious problem that needs to be addressed, and hopefully the organization will assist me in giving me the resources and the manpower to help stop that kind of behavior. Additionally, we need additional training, financial officers training on how to do the reports. We need it more frequently. We have officers who sometimes retire from the government or they get voted out of office, and then there's no training available for the treasurers, and they have to wait sometimes months or maybe up to a year before they can get any training in that particular in their office. And I intend to have monthly training provided here at the national office for treasurers so that they don't have to go months or weeks without getting the necessary training, because the DOL requires, and AFG does also, that they do the reports timely, and the members want to make certain that their money is safeguarded and that people are not ripping them off, because people work hard for their money, and if they choose to join our organization, they want to make certain that their money is going to the programs that they would like to see in terms of helping them to do their job better and and to protect their interests. And when somebody's ripping off their money and using it for their personal gain, it definitely leaves a black eye on the organization, and it tends to cause people to believe that the organization is flawed from the top down and they don't want to be a part of it. I think that we would have much greater membership if we could eliminate those kind of problems and address workers' issues more prominently than we have been, and I think all of that blends in together.
At the top of the interview, you said ultimately your priority here is to serve AFGE's members. And with the wealth of experience that you have as a union official, talk to me about where you see the mood of the membership these days, given the still recovering economy and a lot of the political action on Capitol Hill related to government, the size of government, the role of the federal employee.
I believe workers are a little bit upset with the fact that they haven't gotten a cost of living increase for the last 2 years. The current administration, the Obama administration, is projecting that they'll give them a half a percentage increase starting in April, a whole quarter after the beginning of the year. And, you know, there hasn't been a lot of inflation, but everything still goes up. And in essence, the workers have taken a beating with respect to their wages. It's just not right what's been done to federal employees. I do support Mr. Obama, and I would like to see him reelected, but his administration haven't treated federal workers with the respect that they deserve. One of the things I'd like to see done is that we get up a significant COLA, at least a 3%, you know, sometime before the end of next year, maybe in the middle part of next year. You know, I would like to see it start in January, but apparently that's not going to happen. The other candidate has made it clear that him and Ryan, his vice presidential candidate for Republicans, that they're projecting that it may be a three additional years freeze at a minimum. So in essence, government workers' pay is going to be reduced while maybe the other workers within the government, I'm talking about the legislators, their pay is not being affected. Health insurance is also a concern with federal workers. We believe that the health insurance program could be definitely improved, and we can get better health care and better rates than what we're currently getting. The competition is not what it should be. And so those are two of the primary goals with respect to pay issues. With respect to working conditions, safety is always an issue. Safety in TSA is a major issue with lifting suitcases and luggage. Workers have a lot of workers' comp claims. The Border Patrol, you know, they had a friendly shooting where one of their agents was killed recently, and their equipment needs to be improved. The working conditions need to be improved. I can say that probably with every agency in the VA. They're downgrading low-paid employees in high-cost areas. It's very difficult for them to manage. Matter of fact, the VA in San Francisco, for instance, they've had a retention problem due to not paying adequate wages because it's a high-cost living area, and wages have been cut across the board within the Veterans Administration, primarily in the clerical and the practical nurses field.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Eugene Hudson, Jr., AFGE's National Secretary Treasurer. NST Hudson, obviously the race for the White House is getting a lot of attention, but the House and Senate races, and ultimately which party wins control of those bodies of Congress, will go a long way in determining the future makeup of the federal government. What are your thoughts in that regard?
Well, I think that Mitch McConnell made it very clear early on in the Obama administration that one of his primary goals was to prevent the president from being reelected. I think Boehner in the House is also of the same viewpoint, and they pretty much stalemated any attempts to get legislation passed in the Senate and in the House. I attended the Democratic Convention in Charlotte, and we had the opportunity to meet with a number of Democrats, and Nancy Pelosi had one of her House members give us a district-by-district breakdown of seats that they believe that they can win. And according to that report, they think they need about 25 seats for her to probably become Speaker again. If they can win those 25 seats, then of course the House would be Democratic, and more than likely she'll get the speakership again. And in the Senate, they have to maintain their seats. I noted the senator from Missouri is having a challenge, McCaskill, I think her name is, Senator McCaskill, and also Tester in the state that he's from, and I know that Brown and up in Massachusetts, who's a Republican, is somewhat vulnerable. So I do believe the Democrats have an opportunity to take back the Congress. And if Obama gets reelected, then maybe they can get some of the legislation passed that will be beneficial to working people and low-income people who I believe have gotten a raw deal over the last 30 years since the Reagan administration. It seemed to me that the tide started to change during that period of time. And with respect to labor, after PATCO was basically abolished by President Reagan, labor hasn't recovered from that firing.
You mentioned the Reagan administration, and many of our listeners out there know, of course, you worked during the Reagan administration for the Social Security Administration. During that time, when you look back on your career, what was your favorite thing about being a federal employee?
Well, the interaction with the public. I had to interview the public. I was a claims representative, and so I did disability, retirement, survivors, claims. The public would come in and file their claims, and they would be very glad because they were retiring, or and the people who were disabled would, in some instances, weren't glad to retire or have to get disability, but they were glad that they had a safety net where at least they could have some income coming in to help them and their families. Without that safety net, they probably would have had to go on welfare, which during the Reagan administration, there was significant changes in that program. And I personally think that some of them were justifiable. So it was very pleasing to me to help the public and make certain that their claims were processed timely and in a professional manner, which had to treat people with dignity and respect. And so it was just a period of time where, and it still continues to be that way, where that safety net is there and it helps people when they retire. And many of the people that used to come into the office had no other income. They had worked a lot of years and they needed to retire. They didn't want to work anymore. They were unable to work anymore, and they wanted an income to be able to help pay their bills and for their daily survival. I'm talking about food and lodging. So that was very rewarding to me and for me to assist the public in that forum at that particular time.
Having some sort of income there, a guaranteed income to cover the basic needs to allow for further independence and continued dignity of one's life.
Most definitely.
Now that we have got you here on the East Coast, of course, you're from California, but we've got you here now in Washington, D.C. Are you looking forward to interacting more with some of our D.C. government employees, many of whom reside here in the district and do the work of the D.C. government?
I went on a website to try to read up on them, because they are a little bit different than the people I've dealt with historically. And they have, within AFG, they have what they call a Council One, and they meet monthly here in our national office. I briefly met with some a few weeks ago, and they told me they were going to formally invite me to a meeting so that I could speak with them or speak to them. So I look forward to learning more about their plight here in the district. I also had an opportunity to meet the mayor a few weeks ago during the Black Caucus. And that was pretty interesting. But in terms of the people have been very kind to me. I've moved into the Baltimore area. I like it so far. People tell me I need to get ready for the cold winter. I've never lived in cold weather before, ice or snow or anything like that. So I imagine I have to acclimate to the new climate. But I'm up to the challenge, and I think this organization needed a change or a fusion of different views, and hopefully I will be helpful in trying to accomplish some of the goals. One of the goals that the president of our union has established is for us to get to 300,000 members by December 31st, 2013. And so I hopefully will be able to help him and the organization accomplish that goal. We are challenged by many things, sequestration. The president had his debate last night. He clearly said that there wouldn't be a sequestration. So if what he said is accurate or true, that somewhat eases my mind. But, you know, I don't really work in the government like I used to anymore. And so the workers who will be impacted by this should probably hold the president accountable to what he said in the debate with Mr. Romney last night.
AFGE National Secretary Treasurer Eugene Hudson Jr. NST Hudson, welcome to D.C. Welcome to your new position, and thank you for taking the time to join us here today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll discuss infrastructure investment and the revival of the middle class with Congressman Peter Welch.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Congressman Peter Welch from Vermont. Congressman, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
So we sit here today at the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, but I want to get your sense for what's happening back home in Vermont. Tell me what your constituents are saying about the economy, about job creation, and the direction that we're heading.
Well, they're saying that's the big issue. I mean, people understand that we fell off a cliff with the financial collapse, and the big issue is whether we're going to have an economic revival that focuses on rebuilding and revitalizing the middle class. That's really the core issue. And there probably has never been an election in my lifetime where the direction that the Republican leadership wants to go and the Democratic leadership wants to go are so diametrically opposed. I mean, essentially, one of the questions Republicans are asking is, are we better off? And of course we are better off. We're out of Iraq. Unemployment has stabilized, but it's also way too high. But on the other hand, what you've got is the Democratic administration, President Obama, saying we have to invest in education, scientific research. We've got to have sensible long-term deficit reduction plans. There have to be revenues as part of that solution. And you've got the Republicans who essentially are readopting the Bush policies of low tax, low regulation that cost us lots of jobs. It was a big contributor to the bank crisis. And it lacks the Bush compassionate conservatism component.
When you talk about long-term deficit reduction and needing to generate revenue, how much is enough to get the deficit down to a reasonable point?
Well, you know, I can't give a specific answer, but it's way higher than a sustainable. And what we know is that in order to get it down to a sustainable level, you have to put everything on the table. And that's the clear difference in approach between Mr. Romney and President Obama. Are you going to have the Pentagon make a contribution, make some cuts in domestic discretionary reform, Medicare, and have revenues as part of the solution? That's the Obama approach. Or are you going to put all the cuts in domestic discretionary and continue to lower taxes for very wealthy people? You know, under the Ryan budget, Mr. Romney's taxes would go down to an effective tax rate of 1%. There's no possibility that will get the debt under control. So it's really a matter of what's the right way. Is it everything on the table, or is it doubling down on tax cuts?
Let's talk about that defense spending for a minute. That's obviously a key issue when talking about deficit reduction. How much does the Pentagon get? How much does it need? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts are that the fiscal cliff we have is very bad policy. And if we were acting cooperatively, we'd find a better way to do this. But the Pentagon has the highest budget it's had really in its history. And it's much higher than it was, double what it was in Eisenhower, adjusted for inflation, when we had the threat of the Soviet Union. And the question on the military budget is not just doing top-line cutting. It's asking what are appropriate missions and where can we right-size? Do we need the size of the fleet that we have? Do we need to make adjustments in personnel? Do we need to have as big a presence in Japan? Do we need as many troops in Europe? These are all questions that should be answered from the perspective of what is required for our national security. So the re-examining assumptions about how best to defend America is what will allow us to budget to what we need.
Are you able to have conversations like that with the leaders at the Department of Defense? And what are they saying about some of those issues that you raised about, do we need to have a fleet that big? Are we focused on the right missions?
Well, there's no question that at the leadership level, they are asking some of those questions. And, you know, one of the areas where they've asked the question, but we failed to do anything, is in weapons procurement. You know, we've wasted about $300 billion spending on weapons that we never use or that didn't work. and nobody has been held accountable. That tells you, if we're going to be ordering these gold-plated weapon systems that don't even work, that's a waste, total waste of taxpayer dollars. So there has to be some system reform in the big ticket items as well. So right now it's politicized, it's the campaign, but the bottom line is, are we going to be able to get our debt under control and have legitimate and appropriate investments in the rebuilding of the middle class without having all components of the budget play a role? And that's the Pentagon making a contribution. It's domestic discretionary, but it also means that we've got to look at the revenue side as well.
Sure, it's a very complicated issue. People look at defense spending, and very easy for them to say in one sentence or another, yes, cut it, or no, don't. But it's obviously much more complicated than that.
Well, if you're going to do it right. But, you know, when I listen to CEOs who had to deal with the collapse of our economy in 2008, they had to make cuts. They had to look at everything in their budget. But they told me the really tough decisions was where do we invest? Because if they wanted to be a company that was going to be around when the economy turned, they had to be ready. And that meant spending money even when they were not quite certain where the revenues would come from. So it's a very, very tough situation in a tight economy where you have to do both. You have to make cuts where you can. You've got to look at every program, whether it's in the Pentagon or it's in the Department of Education. But you also have to make investments for the future.
Speaking of those investments for the future, we can talk about infrastructure investments and that sort of thing. But there's also a human capital element of investment that would be beefing up the middle class.
We had to focus on the basics. Infrastructure, broadband deployment, that's really essential. We do not have a 21st century infrastructure system in this country. Everybody knows it. We need that for our economy. Building that infrastructure, repairing it, creates jobs. But we also have to invest in education. What's happening in higher education is becoming unaffordable for average families. They get sticker shock when they look at what it costs to go to school. And they're taking on a level of debt that really puts them with an albatross of debt around their neck when they try to enter into the workforce.
And it's not something that can be wiped away with bankruptcy either. That stays with you. Student loan debt will stay with you, right?
That student loan will stay with you. And, you know, bottom line, we've got to have an affordable education system if kids are going to have an opportunity to achieve their best potential. And I think that requires federal aid, but it also requires that our college administrators stop these tuition increases that are outpacing inflation, wages, and profits.
And I think you're absolutely right. Taking a look at education from the start is where we need to go, because if you get to the point where you're considering bankruptcy because of a student loan, you've already lost.
You have already lost. I mean, the stigma of bankruptcy, the sense of failure of bankruptcy, and obviously the taxpayers can't be afford to be picking up the cost of bankruptcy when that happens. So we've got to have a system that works and is sustainable.
How would you like to see the middle class move forward in the years ahead?
Well, we've reversed what has been historically a constant wage increase. The wages are down compared to about 20 years ago. The jobs that we're creating don't pay enough for middle class families to be able to pay all their bills. And families under a lot of pressure, the only way they're making ends meet is having, if they're lucky, they've got two wage earners. There's a lot of single parent families, and they are oftentimes underwater. So my goal would be that we are starting to create jobs that allow people the wage growth that allows them to keep up with inflation and meeting their needs.
What is your favorite thing about being here at the Democratic Convention this year?
Well, you know, it's a sense of renewal. We've got this huge decision that America has to make, and it's very important that all of America be involved. And this convention focuses attention on the Democratic point of view. The Republican convention obviously focused it on their point of view. And the hope here is that we get as many Americans who don't pay that much attention to politics until it comes time to vote to get as involved as they possibly can be. Because the more citizen involvement we have, the stronger our democracy will be. In my view, it'll be the better decisions that we make as well.
And of course, the outcome of these elections do matter to everybody.
Well, this is extraordinarily consequential. I mean, my view is that if we essentially go back to the Bush tax policies, lowering taxes for very wealthy people, and then cutting the budget on these bare bones programs that help the middle class in education, our infrastructure, scientific research, will be adopting European-style austerity that we know will make unemployment worse, the debt larger.
Congressman Peter Welch from Vermont, certainly appreciate your time and your very serious interest in education in this country. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll talk about workplace concerns at the Federal Aviation Administration with AFGE Local 2282 President Greg Brooks.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Greg Brooks, the president of AFGE's Federal Aviation Administration, Local 2282. Greg, welcome to the program for the first time.
Hey, thanks, Jason. It's glad to be here.
Let's start off by talking a little bit about Local 2282 there at the Federal Aviation Administration. Who do you represent, and what are some of the job functions of those workers?
Actually, we have two contracts, Jason, and one of the contracts deals with aviation safety, AVS. So when commercial flyers step onto an aircraft, they think about how reliable, how safe-oriented it is, and because there's a lot of built-in redundancies in the systems. And people at the Certified Air Medical Institute there at the Mike Maroney Aeronautical Center, a.k.a. CAMI, they do research, human factor research, on pilots. They do it on air traffic controllers. They do it on mechanics. So every time someone steps on an aircraft, it's the safest mode of transportation there is available in the commercial industry, and we're part of it, and I'm proud of our members and non-members alike.
How long have you been the president of Local 2282?
I got elected in October of 2010.
And what was that that compelled you to get into the labor movement and be a part of this local from a leadership standpoint?
From a leadership standpoint, I think it was because I came from the private sector. I bring 25 years private sector experience. I'm a retired Teamster, and I transitioned back into the government. I worked for the government before I worked in the Teamster environment, and I came back, and I was compelled to run. It's been a burning desire of mine, lifelong commitment to the labor movement, for me to just step back and watch what was going on around me. I thought maybe I could provide something different vision. And that's why I ran. I wanted to provide some different ideas, incorporate some of my ideas with other people's ideas, and move forward and hopefully bring about change to make the union better. And that's why I ran.
Now, Greg, your local has become a model at AFGE for its representation around workers' compensation and health and safety issues. Why do you think that is, and what are some examples of situations that you have had to deal with?
What's unique about our board, and I can't speak for other boards within AFGE, we have a special board, and two of the board members on our special board, one is a safety coordinator, and the other one is our occupational workers' compensation specialist, and they are very vital to our local union. And the reason that is that we incorporate our day-to-day responsibilities and activities with their responsibilities. So we get calls about people getting injured on the job. I don't know how to fill out a CA-1 or a CA-2 form. And we lead them in the right direction. So we develop a relationship with our non-members and members alike through those tools. We also have the radar repair facility branch deals and supports the NAS, the National Airway System. So we have people that climb throughout the United States. I'm talking about towers, long-range towers, these radome towers that you see up mountains. And we also see radome towers and radars at terminal facilities at airports. We're very safety-oriented. We actually had Charlie Brandon, our safety coordinator, actually go out and do some inspections with some CBP FAA is also into Customs Border Patrol work in the southwest part of the United States, and that involves going out and repairing these Customs Border Patrol radar systems that are strategically placed around the boundaries or the borders of the United States.
So it sounds like there is some level of inherent danger in working for the FAA that might be one of the reasons why your local has been so actively involved in health and safety issues?
Yeah, hazardous duty pay is very important to us. We want to make sure our people are rewarded for their due diligence when it comes to safety concerns and hazards that are exposed to hazards. And we have some interesting sites. In Ashton, Idaho, I believe the site's about 10,500 feet up. It's a winding road. It's subject to snowfall up probably 4 or 5 feet, freezing conditions. And then we have to go up there and perform maintenance, routine maintenance and unscheduled maintenance on these radars. So, yeah, it's very difficult and very hazardous for our workers. And thank God that we have a safety record that's second to none.
I think some of the things that you're describing are new to some people, at least listening to the show perhaps, because a lot of times when FAA is in the news, it has something to do around the positions in air traffic control, the people sitting up in the towers, in the airports. So that's not necessarily all of what FAA does then, correct?
Yeah, FAA is made up of 49,000 employees. And out of those 49,000 employees, that we approximately have 19,000 air traffic controllers. Yes, they are, to coin a phrase, they are the big elephant in the room. Those positions are very notable. But our people behind the scenes, our engineering group, our ESC group, Enterprise Services Center, these people work too and support the NAS and support the franchise funds and keep us going. This is the accountability aspect of it behind the scenes that no one ever sees. You're absolutely correct.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Greg Brooks, the president of AFGE's FAA Local 2282. Greg, your local has grown under your leadership to about 248 members right now. What was it that sparked this growth in membership, and why is that so important to you to really grow that local?
Well, it's not me. It's the combination of people that I've surrounded myself with, ran for elections, and got involved and are committed. I mean, this is just when others see our executive board and special board's commitments, things that we do in the grievance machinery, our EEO process, we're there to fight for the rights of the employees, and that's what we do. And as an end result, people see it, and they consider us possibly difference makers, maybe not all, but overall, we're very aggressive when it comes to campaigning. And so we get out and talk to people. And when we talk to people, we talk about the advantages. I very rarely talk about money in the first conversation. It's not about money. It's about involvement. It's so important to get people to come to the union meetings, and it's so important to get people to get involved and carry the message back. So and then once they find out that we're committed, they usually join.
When they see that you're committed, it makes them a little more comfortable committing themselves?
Correct. And let me reemphasize, Jason, this isn't my local. It's the members' local, and we work as a team. And so we've got some successes.
It's very much like the AFGE philosophy from a nationwide standpoint, with a grassroots effort, a really ground up approach where the members drive the direction of the union.
Yes, but it has to come. We get support from our national, our regional, our national vice president, Mike Kelly. And another interesting thing, we have a neighbor local at Tinker Air Force Base, and it's called AFG Local 916. And James Smith heads that local union. We came to James and said, hey, are you guys involved in some training? What kind of training you guys got going on that we can take advantage of? And they've opened their arms up, and they've saved our local at least $10,000 this year alone on training. On EEO training, on MSPB training, on grievance machinery, and that's so important that as a small local, that we can save cost or cut cost, and pass it on back to the members to do other things that need to be done. It's a great relationship that we have with them, and we're very fortunate that they're in our area.
Greg, as we talked about earlier, some of these inherent dangers that come with working at FAA and some of these select positions make the service of workers' compensation and health and safety representation, very attractive to not only your existing members but also potential members. So that's one recruiting tool that you might have when you go and talk to potential members. But what are some other things that you talk to the members about, potential members, when trying to get them to possibly join the union?
Not only do we talk about what you just stated, but we talk about them becoming a difference maker. It's putting the responsibility back on the member and the non-member's back. It's a shared responsibility. You're only as strong as the weakest link in your chain. And so we emphasize that. How can we come in and create an environment when nobody's on board? We got to get people on board. We got to not sell the message, but show how everybody can benefit when everybody's pulling in the right direction, utilizing energies, utilizing their recommendations, their thoughts. Let me emphasize again, this is not my local. It's never been my local. It's the members local and non-members alike to get on board and create an environment that we all can prosper.
When you take that philosophy into a meeting with management saying, listen, it's not just me sitting here at the table. It's all of us. It's all nearly 250 of us coming through the door. How do they respond, and how is your relationship with management based on that premise?
Well, you know, I can't give all my trade secrets out on the radio. I got to be very cautious if they happen to listen to this radio station. And so I kind of giggle and laugh about that. We have a collaborative effort here on the local level at FAA in Oklahoma City. But it's about sincerity, it's about trust, it's about straightforwardness. So we confront the issue for what the issue is and try to find some resolution to resolve that issue at the lowest level possible and save taxpayers money. Maybe 95% of the people out there in the free world just think that we're here to create job protection for ourselves. It's not that. It's about job security in the future. It's about if you don't plan for a future, you're not going to have one.
It sounds like that really is your mantra, if you will. And as you had said earlier, when you're talking to potential new members, you don't even talk about money. You talk about the issues. You talk about the things that really matter, trying to make the workplace safer, make their day-to-day lives better, and build towards the future.
The state of Congress right now, people have got their hands up in the air running around like the end of the world's coming. Well, it very well be if sequestration takes effect. So we're proactive on getting people to get out and vote and register to vote and vote for the right candidate. That's an important thing. If they're going to vote, you need to vote for the candidate that supports the union worker.
How important are these upcoming elections to your local going forward?
Well, it's very important because we're dealing with a situation, and I have to be very careful. We want to educate our members and non-members alike to vote for the candidate so we can sustain our business line from our end of it. Because if you've got a candidate out there running to eliminate government, reduce the size of government, just arbitrarily, without looking at the functions or the activities that we produce or manufacture or negotiate an outcome. I'll give you a fine example. In October of last year, we furloughed 84 FAA employees because Congress couldn't get their stuff together. But so 84 people that dealt with human factors, doing research, very committed people, went home for 2 weeks with no pay. 7,000 construction contractors that worked on airports went home with no pay. And I'm not advocating for the rights of the contractors. I'm advocating for the rights of the federal worker that went home because of bad judgment by Congress. That's what's upsetting.
Greg, how dangerous is it to take that approach towards the federal government with just widespread cuts without really thinking about the impact not only on the business of the federal government, but also the individual who's doing the job?
People at FAA are committed to do a job. They're unique jobs. They're specialist jobs. When you're talking about working on long-range radar that supports the NAS, those aren't jobs that are out there that you can pick somebody off the street and have them come do it. It's usually someone that's been in the military service, someone that's got a technical background. That's just one part of the equation. But if you remove one part of the equation out of the plan, then the plan fails. We're here to keep all the pieces on the table.
Greg, you currently sit on the FAA's Labor Management Relations Committee and have been recently named to the same position on the Department of Transportation's Labor Management Forums. What is it like being in those situations and working directly with the managers of the federal government trying to address issues that come up?
Well, let me point out that these are high-level managers. These are administrators for FAA. It's encouraging, though, to sit down and meet with these people and go face to face. And we try to keep our issues global. And it's not just FAA, AFGE. It's NATCA, it's PASS, it's PACE, it's ILUNA. There's different NAGE NEFI. There's different unions. So we try to make our issues global, and we address those in a professional manner. We have a charter of made up of representatives and agency reps. And so it's we meet quarterly. And I've recently been appointed to the DOT forum, but they've suspended their meetings until after the election, so I really can't speak on that DOT environment. But one of the most important things that's coming down right now with the FAA Labor Management Forum is the pay systems. I think they want a pay system that's going to be uniformed, where all the labor unions can benefit it. And but you're dealing with classifications of employees, you're dealing with collective bargaining agreements, so it is kind of complex. But they want to simplify the system what they have now. So we're moving in that direction. And if we get there, we get there. If we don't, then we'll fall back and learn from our process and go back and look at it from a different angle.
What are you most hoping to accomplish out of these forums?
Well, the forums, there are executive orders from the president. Now, I have to say this. When Obama came in, he signed an executive order for a labor management forum. The gentleman before him didn't do that. So we're hoping that that we continue, and we will continue, to operate as a labor management forum, even if a candidate gets elected, it may not be our friend.
Greg Brooks, the president of AFGE's Federal Aviation Administration, Local 2282. Greg, great to have you here with us today. Thanks for taking the time.
Hey, I appreciate it, Jason. Thanks a lot. And again, I'd like to close by saying we're just a small local, but we're moving upward. I encourage all locals out there to start small and think large, but get committed and get involved and make a difference in people's lives.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll address the importance of the Hispanic vote with Democratic National Committee Senior Advisor for Hispanic Affairs, Juan Sepulveda.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab, or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Juan Sepulveda, the Senior Advisor for Hispanic Affairs for the Democratic National Committee. Juan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Obviously, the Hispanic vote figures to be quite important on Election Day. Juan, tell me what you're doing to mobilize the base in that regard.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. The Hispanic vote is going to be critical this time around in this election cycle. We've been doing a number of things. I think probably the most important thing for us is that we're not starting late in the game. I came on to the DNC in November of 2011, so about a year ago. And so I think one thing we feel very proud of is that President Obama's reelection effort aimed at the Latino community is the earliest, the largest, the most respectful, the most expansive campaign in American history that's ever been aimed at the Latino community. And I think we came in from the campaign side building on the conversations that we've been having since we've come into office. And so I think another real strong point for us is that the White House and the different agencies, I was a former appointee, running a White House office focused on education in the Latino community. A lot of us had been out there for so long, naturally building and strengthening the relationships we've had with Latino leaders across the country. And I think we were able to build upon that on the campaign side when we really got things kind of moving about a year ago. And so what we've done is really taken kind of a really deep community organizing approach to take the time to be on the ground, particularly in the key battleground states, so that we could start off by hearing directly from the voters and kind of hearing from them what they were thinking and their take on the key issues for the campaign. And then we could then obviously then kind of be able to respond and talk about what we've already accomplished for the Latino community and then kind of what the president wants to do moving in the next 4 years. So there's been a real combination of both kind of an air game and a ground game. The first ad that the DNC ran from the campaign side was a Spanish ad aimed at the Latino community. And once we've kind of put those ads up, we haven't stopped. So there's been a continuous kind of stream of both television and radio ads that we've been doing aimed at the Latino community, in addition to having folks on the ground in the battleground states. And for the first time ever, we've had kind of Latino vote directors in the key states. So in the past, presidential campaigns have never really done that, or they've done it late in the game, or they've had someone who kind of shared responsibility. They were doing one thing and wore a number of hats. But we decided to early on make sure that we were investing in those states and in the communities and putting people on the ground in a full-time basis to really kind of be just in charge of the Latino vote within their own battleground state. So those are the kinds of things we've been doing to make sure we're building on the relationships we've had from the time we came into office.
Juan, you talk about being in the community and engaging with Latino voters. When you talk to them about their concerns, what's at the top of the list? What are the top two or three things that you're saying to you that's on their minds the most before Election Day?
So I think we've been very fortunate to have those conversations, and they've been going on for a really long time. So I think there actually are five big buckets that we've heard from the community that kind of across the board, no matter where we are in the country, have kind of popped up to the top of the list. The number one issue, which kind of matches what most American voters are kind of feeling, is around the issue of the economy and jobs. But in addition to the economy and jobs, education, health care, immigration are three other issues. So those four issues are probably the ones we hear the most from the community. But a fifth one is the notion of inclusion, of just making sure that Latinos have a voice and a presence both in the administration and the campaign and all the different things that are a part of what the Obama administration is about. There's been that kind of fifth overarching theme of just about, you know, we're always being asked, how many Latino appointees do you have and what positions? And, you know, people obviously feel great about Sonia Sotomayor is the first Latino on the Supreme Court. So there's kind of an inclusion piece that I would say is kind of the fifth, in addition to the economy and jobs, education, healthcare, and immigration.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Juan Sepulveda, the Senior Advisor for Hispanic Affairs for the DNC. Juan, you mentioned your time in the White House. Of course, you were the director of the White House Initiative on Educational Excellence for Hispanic Americans, a position that seems to go quite well with bucket number two that you mentioned on the concerns of Latino voters, and that's education. How has the administration tackled that that issue for the voters?
That's one area that we feel really great about, and I think is one of our biggest highlights in terms of the success that we've had, both in kind of the approach we've taken to education that is now getting applied to lots of other areas of government, and that's around kind of the race to the top approach. But in addition to the race to the top approach on the process side, I think on the content side, we've been able to, as we talk to the Latino community, they understand, because across the board, Latinos are now the largest minority at the pre-K level, at the K through 12 level, and while we always had the largest numbers and had the potential to be the largest minority group within colleges, that just took place as we've come into office. And so across the board, it's a huge issue for Latinos. And what we've been able to do, and folks have been seeing in a real way, you know, an increase in a number of Head Start positions and early Head Start spots, a focus on early education that is critical for the Latino community. You know, the race to the top approach to get 40 plus states to step up, to change the way they're doing business and say, if you could have a race to the top, if you could do and change and reform the education system in a way that really is going to serve kids in a better way, what would you do? And I think that, coupled with a lot of the strategy of the turnaround schools, with knowing that the federal government doesn't have unlimited dollars, and so that you've got to really be smart in how you strategically place those dollars, and placing those dollars in the turnaround schools, the schools that are struggling the most, that a lot of people have given up on, that unfortunately a lot of times are the schools in the Latino communities, but getting those resources and being able to work as partners has really turned things around on the K-12 side. And then I think another thing we feel very proud of is the Pell Grant, college scholarships. In the 8 years before we came into office, President Bush did not increase the Pell Grants by a penny. I've got two kids in college, so this is not theoretical. We know the college costs are going up, and so with the president being able to double the amount of Pell Grants and increase the individual amount of Pell Grants, what that's led to has been an explosion on the Latino side of kids going to college for the first time, and it has now led to Latinos being actually larger than the previous number one group of African Americans in terms of who are now starting college. Now, we have to make sure they get through, but across the board, I think, and the president has said, both in terms of the success we've had, but in moving forward in the next 4 years of a second term, of making that national priority of education and training at the top of the list of the agenda. And so we feel very good about the successes we've had there. A good example is, while there aren't enough Latinos going to college, and we've bumped up those numbers, we're talking about 20% increases over on an annual basis, which has just been off the charts. But we still know that most Latinos are starting, for example, at the community college level. So strengthening community colleges and a big investment of $2 billion from the administration. So across the board, education within the Latino community, I was one of those who was very fortunate to be the first one to go to college in my family. But I think so many folks understand that that's a key path to the American dream.
Juan, do you think that with improvements in education, more job opportunities, a more robust economy, improved health care, do you think improvements in those areas would go a long way to number five on your list, which is the inclusion piece for Latinos?
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely all right. When we think about Obamacare, on the healthcare side, Latinos we have the highest rates of uninsured of any of the minority groups in the country. And so our estimates are that when Obamacare is fully implemented in 2014, there will be 9 million more Latinos who have healthcare. That's just off the charts. And so once again, the community understands right now, because so many of them are struggling without healthcare coverage. We've already seen that some of the provisions that have already kicked in, and in addition to Obamacare, when we first came into office, the expansion of the Children's Health Insurance Program, for the first time ever, immigrant kids were included in the Children's Health Insurance Program. But even beyond that, looking to some of the key provisions from Obamacare that have already been put into place, the ability for kids to stay on their parents' health insurance until they're 26 has led to almost 800,000 more Latinos who are now able to continue and to get health care coverage. And just some of the other pieces around preventive services for the seniors, the closing of the donut hole, all those kinds of things. I think we've been very fortunate for the community to see how it's impacted their day-to-day life. But they also know that within the next couple of years, just the ability for 9 million more Latinos to have health care is really significant. Significant for the community. And hand in hand with education, once again, the president has tied that so directly to the notion of what the future needs to hold in terms of jobs. So it's not just about education in general. If you're the president talking about a focus on creating 100,000 new science and math teachers, and because we know that the STEM jobs, the science, technology, engineering, and math jobs, are the jobs of the 21st century. If you look at the majors of folks graduating from college, the top 10 highest paying career tracks are all related to the STEM field, and it's a place where we've unfortunately have fallen behind some other countries. And so I think from an international competitive stance, the president sees that as being very linked once again to making sure that we get to the top again, and setting a goal to be number one by the year 2020. And the percentage of our population that has a piece of paper beyond high school. And so all of those things kind of come together, I think, to really make sure that the Latino community is included in a way that they haven't been in the past.
Juan Sepulveda, the Senior Advisor for Hispanic Affairs for the Democratic National Committee. Juan, appreciate your time today and coming on the show and talking with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you to our guest this week, AFGE National Secretary Treasurer Eugene Hudson Jr., Congressman Peter Welch, AFGE Federal Aviation Administration Local 2282 President Greg Brooks, and Democratic National Committee Senior Advisor for Hispanic Affairs Juan Sepulveda. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you by the American Federation of Government Employees. WFED.